privilege of being the first speaker for this semester, and usually the semester opens with a talk that is introductory, in a way. But to cater to those senior practitioners around here, I would also like to take the talk to a different level as well. But what better way to talk about Buddhism than the Buddha himself? So today we're going to talk about Buddha. But the topic is about Buddha not being a Buddhist god. And that's an important distinction because a lot of times people who don't come from a Buddhist background, they may come from another religion, or that their only understanding of religion is based on, say for example, the Christian paradigm. We can't use another religion's paradigm to understand Buddhism. It won't work. And so I will say that the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist god, and isn't one, and nor should he be seen that way. And there is a particular reason for that. But even for those Buddhists themselves, we should also question our own understanding of who the Buddha was and what we see his importance is and why we bow down to him when we see his statue. So, I share with you my own Buddhist family upbringing. When I grew up, when I was yay high, I was told that the Buddha knew everything. Right? He knew everything, he saw everything, and he would punish me with karma if I ever did anything wrong. And if I did anything right, I would collect merit points. Okay? And he could do that because he was able to do so. Now, for those who have come from a particular Asian Buddhist family, does that sound familiar? You go to the temple and you pray and you hope that something good will come from it. Now, in a way, I see some people nodding. Isn't that a bit like God and the definition of God? Because if you think about it, God, he, first of all, the first quality is that he's supposed to be a supernatural creator, someone who created the universe. And that's why I think a lot of people come to Buddhism and they ask, so, who did create the universe? Yeah? I get that question a lot. The other quality is the fact that God is omniscient. He's all-knowing. He knows everything. And that he has unlimited power. He's all-present. He's perfect in goodness. And he's eternal. I would say that some people view the Buddha as having these qualities. But actually, the Buddha wasn't a god. When the Buddha was enlightened and he came walking down the road, someone actually approached him and stopped him. And this Brahmin, who's a Hindu priest, his name is Dona, and he asked the Buddha these questions. Sir, are you a god? A deva? No, Brahmin. Sir, are you a heavenly angel? No, no. Sir, are you a demon? No, I'm not. Are you a human being? No, I'm not. So what are you indeed? And the Buddha replied, I am awake. As a lotus, fair and lovely, by the water is not soiled, by the world am I not soiled. Therefore, Brahmin, am I the Buddha, the awakened one. So here we can see that the Buddha was in the world, but he wasn't of the world. So although he was born human, through his own effort and practice of meditation, of morality and wisdom, the Buddha was able to abandon his defilements of greed, hatred and delusion so that he could awaken to the truth of liberation. Now, the fact that he was a human is really important to us Buddhist practitioners. The fact that he was a human and not a god should be an inspiration to us, because it means that we, as humans, can also attain liberation. It isn't something that exists out there. Freedom from suffering can happen to us right in this life. At every single moment, we have a chance to be enlightened. So I do commend to understand the Buddha's teachings from that perspective. So some of you may come and ask, So why do Buddhists revere the Buddha if the Buddha wasn't a god? And I ask the Buddhists here, why do you bow down to the Buddha when you see his statue? What is the reason? Anyone want to share the thought? Very good. In fact, for a long time, and a lot of practitioners, that's what they do. They bow to the Buddha to thank him for his teachings, and that's a valid reason as well. Do you bow down to him as a person? Do you bow down to the fact that he is someone that we can aspire to? Do we have that connection with the Buddha? You know, when I was growing up, I never had that connection. I mean, I'm being very honest here. I sort of thought, oh yeah, you know, the Buddha's over there, and I pray to him when I need good marks for school or, you know, something like that. But I never really connected to him because I never was inspired about his life. I never understood it. And I would imagine most people, they don't connect with him because they get an abridged version of his life. If I asked you, what is the story of the Buddha? Take a moment. You have to tell me. Think about what you know about the story. How would you explain his story to someone? Just take a moment to think. And can I suggest, it would go something like this. He was born, he took 7 steps, he grew up in a palace, luxurious life, he saw the 7 sights. Take one step back. He got married, that's important. He saw the 4 sights, sorry. Seeing the 4 sights, he decided to leave the palace and the worldly life, renunciate, go in search for the truth, sat under a tree. He practiced asceticism for a while, so he starved himself for a while, sat under a tree, got enlightened, taught for a bit, then passed away. Sound something like that? The majority of my life, that was a story that I knew. But there is chunks of his life missing from me. And in particular, what is missing is the 45 years in which, after he got enlightened through passing away, 45 years he taught the Dharma. All of the sutras that we know come from his life. It was told in a particular context. Most of them was within those 45 years. That is how important those 45 years are. And yet, when you hear the abridged version of his life, it's never mentioned. But it's those years that are so inspiring, equally so to his quest to enlightenment. So, today we're going to talk about a few of those stories, not everything, because I don't think we can ever cover that within 2 hours. But I would like you to have a think about this, because I really want you to come out of this lecture knowing that you have gained something, hoping that this would interest and inspire you to learn more about the Buddha's story in depth, more than the abridged version. Because if you are serious about understanding the Buddha's teachings and about understanding the sutras, you have to place them into context. And how you know that is through the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha's story himself. The Buddha's story has so many messages. It is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So, let's go to the story. Oh, this is a tanka. This is a Tibetan tanka, and it depicts his stories, essentially. Now, sometimes people begin with him, being born, or even just taking a step back, his mum having a dream. But really, there is a whole series of stories called the Jataka tales, which show the Buddha before he was born into that life as Siddhartha. Before that, he was what we call a bodhisattva, someone who was on the path of practice to enlightenment. And one of those lives, he was the ascetic Samida, who is the person who's lying on this ground, okay? Okay? That's him. That's the Buddha, the Siddhartha Buddha, the Gautama Buddha that we know today. Okay? Over here, this is the previous Buddha. Right? Dipankara Buddha is him, and there's his disciples. So that's the first thing we need to know. The Buddha is not the only Buddha ever. It is said that one day his teaching is also impermanent. His teaching will fade from the memory and from the understanding of the current era. And then there will be a future Buddha to be born. And people said his name is Maitreya Buddha. So you may see him, a lot of times people depict him as, you know, the jolly fat Buddha. That's Maitreya Buddha. Over here, this lady here, she's interesting. People often forget her when they tell this story. Her name is Sumita, and she will be reborn later on as Yasodhara, who is the wife of Siddhartha. You will see that she's holding some lotus, and so does the ascetic. There are five lotuses that were given to the ascetic and three that she keeps herself. This is a picture to show the fact that ascetic Sumita saw the previous Buddha walking by. He was going to walk through a muddy pond. And what he did was he laid himself over that muddy pond in order for that previous Buddha to walk over him so he didn't dirty himself. That was his way of showing his respect. And also, he vowed to become a Buddha in a future life. And that's when the previous Buddha made the prediction that he one day will attain enlightenment and he will be the next Buddha. And likewise, he will have companions who will follow him throughout all of these lifetimes. Okay. Remember these characters? I'll come back to them. Okay. Prior to the Buddha being born, he wasn't born called the Buddha, by the way. So he was born into a royal family. So I'll call him the Prince Siddhartha. The prince's mother is called Maya, and she had a dream that there was a white elephant that came into her room and entered the left side of her body. And when she woke, the king summoned some of the wise men to decipher what that dream actually meant. And what it means is that there will be someone great who will be born to the royal family. And of course, that's referring to Siddhartha. Eventually, the Siddhartha was born in Lumbini Park near Nepal, or in Nepal, present day Nepal. And you will see here to the right, well, my right, that's the dream of the white elephant. And over here is the depiction of Siddhartha walking seven steps. Now, I know by now you're probably thinking, are you kidding? Seven steps? A baby walking? I think what has happened is there's been depictions of these seven steps in art, and people have taken it literally. The seven steps represents the seven factors of enlightenment. So for him to be born and taken these seven steps, it means that it's not a literal seven steps. It's a metaphoric, symbolic meaning of taking those seven steps for the factors of enlightenment. And those seven factors are, the first is mindfulness, second is investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. It's also said that he stood up with his right arm pointing to the sky and his left finger pointing to the ground, and he said, "Chief am I in this world." And again, it may not be literal, but what it does say is it is an honour for this person to be born into this world. Okay. Now, as I said, Siddhartha was born into the royal family, and some people forget that it's actually important to know who the Sakya clan is. The royal family of the Sakya clan. over here at the top we've got the father's side, the father's family tree, and over here we have the mother's family tree. Okay? The paternal and maternal family. Why it's important is if you have a look, you will see that a lot of these names crop up in his story later on. And that's because the Buddha didn't just abandon his family in search for the truth. He actually returned and taught the truth to them, and a lot of them became his disciples and eventually attained enlightenment. So if you just have a look here, for example, Devadatta, the cousin, we'll come back to him. Rahula is his son. Yasodhara, who we've also already mentioned, is the wife. Nanda became his disciple. Who else is it? Kissa. Ananda, we all know Ananda, don't we? His personal attendant is his cousin, okay? So all of these people, they will reappear. After Siddhartha was born, he wasn't given a name immediately, so the royal family had a naming ceremony for him, and that's when they gave him that name of Siddhartha, which means wish-filled, which is, of course, ironic. He was also given the his family name was Gautama, which is why sometimes you will note he's referred to as Gautama Buddha, and that's because of his family name. Sakyamuni is another name you may hear from time to time, Sakyamuni Buddha. That was a title that was given to him in honour of him being basically the sage of the Sakya clan. So Sakyamuni, that's how it came about. Why the naming ceremony is important to his story is because there were a few wise men who went there. Not only gave the name, but also gave predictions based on the characteristics, the physical characteristics of Siddhartha. And they predicted that there would be two possible outcomes for this person. The first is either he will become a great ruler, right? Which is when the king said, yes, that's what I want. Or the other possibility is that once he sees impermanence, he will abandon the worldly ways and he will become a great teacher. So those were the two options. There was a particular sage there called Asita. He said there will only be one option, and that is he will abandon the worldly ways in order to find its truth, and he will become enlightened. That find liberation and become a great teacher. That was his prediction. Why that prediction is important is because that played in the father's mind, the king's mind, constantly throughout the prince's childhood. And so the king constructed three palaces within the palace to entertain the prince, so that the prince never felt like he needed anything, and he felt that life is good. There was no need to look for suffering because everything that he had was there. The three palaces, I'll just tell you because they're quite amazing. There is one for winter, okay? There is one, so that's the one made out of fragrant timber, okay? There's one made out of marble, which is for summer, and one for the rainy season, which is made out of brick, okay? They've only got three seasons, they don't have four. So, he was there, and another thing as well is in the palace, anyone who was old, who was sick, who was depressed, anything that could show suffering or sorrow had to be removed immediately. So anyone over a certain age, gone. Okay, anyone who coughs, gone. Even a falling leaf, this is documented, even a falling leaf from a tree had to be swept up immediately because it showed impermanence. That's the extent of how closed off Siddhartha was from the real world. If you think we live in a bubble, I mean, he was in, like, a real bubble. There was one incident in his youth, which, again, people don't really refer to. That's the ploughing festival. Annually, the king will go out and with the people, they would celebrate agriculture, okay? Because back then, agriculture was the lifeblood of the country, And what they would have is they would have obviously the bulls toiling, okay, because it's a ploughing festival, so they'll be ploughing away, okay, and then there will be loads and loads of celebration. When Siddhartha went there, he saw this, and instead of staying there like regular people and enjoying the festivities, instead he wandered off when people weren't watching, into his own secluded spot, and he sat under a rose apple tree. And then he contemplated. He fell into a natural state of meditation and of contemplation. He was only very young. And he contemplated on the suffering of the bulls, of how they have to toil every single day, yeah? The suffering that they must go through. And also it said that when the soil was overturned, a worm came out. And the worm was immediately eaten. I know here we've got a lizard, and it's eaten by a snake, and then an eagle comes. There's always different animals. I've done a lot of research into this, okay? They either have a worm eaten by a bird, and the bird's eaten by a snake, or something like that. That doesn't matter. The point is, what he does contemplate on is the suffering that exists in life. The selfishness, the self-centeredness, of each sentient being. This is what he contemplates. And it is said that it is under the rose apple tree that he attained the first jhana, which is the first meditative state. This is actually a really important event, and I'll come back to it later on and you'll know why. So, back to the palace. He continues to live a luxurious life. But he also was quite, he was a very good kid, by the way, okay? He excelled in everything. He excelled in archery, in war, so studies of war, in literature, everything you can think of, okay? People loved him. But he was also the type of person who contemplated a lot on life, as you can imagine. And the king got really worried. So the king thought, what will fix a man? Okay, so he arranged a marriage. and of all of the women in the kingdom, the prince chose, wait for it, his cousin, Yasodhara. So Princess Yasodhara became his wife. Now Yasodhara, as we already mentioned, is Samita from his previous wife. So that constant companion who has and in the Jataka tales, she reappears again and again and again. She's the one who's helped him throughout all of these lifetimes so that he can attain enlightenment. So there she is, sitting over there, being fanned. That's not her. That's just an entertainer. Okay. Oh, and then, they also had a son. I don't know if you know that, but Siddhartha had a son. And Siddhartha named the son Rahula, which means impediment. It's a bit sorry for the kid, but the reason why he's called him Rahula is because just when Siddhartha thought he was ready to renunciate his way, that's when Rahula was born. So he was an impediment to him renunciating, which really means he thought twice about whether he wanted to renounce. Yeah, it was sort of like a hesitation. I've got a child now. I won't spoil the story for you, I'll come back to that. But that's why his name is Rahula. Okay, the story continues that Siddhartha, in his contemplation, he thought, I really want to go beyond the palace walls. I want to see what the world outside looks like. So he did. He asked his dad again and again, and he nagged and he nagged and he nagged. And you know how teenagers can be, right? The more you tell them not to do something, that's exactly what they want to do. Right? So, the king eventually said, okay, all right, you can go. Right? And the king, he was very clever. He actually told everyone that you must clean the streets, clear everything, right? All the old, all the ugly, all the sick, gone. But regardless of that, still Siddhartha was able to see the famous four spots. He didn't see them all at once, by the way. He went on several visits and he saw them. And why he was able to see them was he went into the countryside where they didn't really hear about the king's proclamation. Okay, what are the four sites? Who would like to tell me one of them? They're up there. So the first person he sees... Yeah? Yeah, the old man. I mean, the order doesn't really matter, but the old man. But he didn't even realise it was an old man. He just saw someone who was crooked over, struggling to walk. You know, the hair was all white, all tangled up. Channa, do you see him? He's the charity. He asked Channa, who is this bloke? And we're like, who is this man? And why is he crooked over like that? And what has happened to his hair? What happened to his teeth? What happened to his skin? And Channa says, this is an old man. Well, what has happened to him? How did he become that way? Oh, this is what happens with age. Everyone goes through this. You mean, I'm going to be like this? My father, my mother, well, actually, my mum passed away, but my father, my wife? Yes, everyone. And likewise, when he saw the sick man, again, he didn't know what that was, and he asked Channa. And same reply, everyone will experience sickness. And the third sight is that of a dead man. Everyone will experience death. And that's when Siddhartha thought, wow. And we are going, and remember this is back in India when they thought that they believed in reincarnation. That was something that was accepted. So he knew that people will come back again and again and experience these three different types of poisons again and again. And there was no release, no liberation from it. And he thought there must be a way out. We can't keep doing this, lifetime after lifetime. And that's when the foresight came through, and it was such an inspiration to him. Some people call them a monk, more like a wandering ascetic, someone who's out there, who's abandoned the worldly ways in order to search for the truth. And he aspired to be like this person, to search for the truth. Because he wanted to find a way out of suffering, not only for himself, but out of compassion for all sentient beings. So with great reluctance, but with compassion in his heart, he decided to leave his family. And keeping in mind he's just got a newborn. Now, some people say, that's quite harsh of him to abandon his family. A bit selfish, isn't it? But remember, he did this. His intention was right. His intention was he wanted to search for the truth because he knew that his family will have all the material comfort and security that the king can provide to them. But they won't escape old age, sickness and death. And that's why he went on this quest. So he left his family. He left the palace and luxurious life. He left his way to the throne too. He was going to take over. He was going to be the next in line. And he didn't leave when he was stressed out. You know how sometimes people say, oh, you know what, I'm too stressed, I'm going to become a monk, right? He wasn't even that. He was at the height of his life. He was 29 years old. That's pretty young. So in that sense, he did it with the right intention. And then that's when he decided to leave the palace. And this is a famous picture you may see again and again. What it is he's cutting off his hair, which is his sign that he will cut off the worldly ties. It's his renunciation. Channa, who's there with him, takes his horse back with him. It's said that the heavenly angels came down and picked up his hair and took it to heaven where it still remains. Okay? And it also says that his horse was asked to go back to the kingdom, right, away from his master, and he died halfway through of a broken heart. That's part of the story too. really bad. But that's the great pronunciation. Siddhartha's search for the truth came through a few methods. The first thing that he tried out was meditation. Back in India, there were so many different people who were practicing a whole range of stuff. And one of them was meditation. But the meditation is different to the meditation that the Buddha has taught. Okay? Their meditation is based on concentration rather than contemplation. So what it was about focusing the mind, achieving jhanas, and remaining in that blissful state. The concentration was an end on its own, rather than meditation being a means to an end, as it is taught in Buddhism. So that's the difference. But regardless, he found one of the meditation masters who was known in those days, and it said after some period of practice that Siddhartha actually surpassed the teachings of his own master. And so he went in search for someone else, and he found a second meditation master. And again, he learned everything that he could possibly learn and attained an even higher meditative state than his master. And so with gratitude, he bowed down to the meditation master and left. The other phase that people were going through back then was about asceticism. And the ascetic practice is about self-torture, self-mortification. And that's where they will starve themselves. They will basically stand out in the sun. They won't sit for a while, for example. So they will torture their body. They will deliberately afflict pain onto their body. And what they were thinking was that if they could release their own attachments to this body, as well as to be able to understand what that is, they will be able to reach the mind. Or some sort of release from the worldly way. But of course that's very extreme. And he got to a point where Siddhartha, he was having such a terrible time. He actually practiced with five other ascetics. So you will see them in the background, five of them. And they sort of helped each other. But in a way, Siddhartha was able to take asceticism to the highest level, to the point where it is said in the scriptures, when he touched the front of his body, he can feel the back of his spine, because he had just stopped eating completely. And that's a typical image of the ascetic practice. To a point where he was actually going to die. And just when he was going to, he fainted, and it is said that shepherd boys came over and were able to revive him with the sheep's milk. And that's the only way he survived. And when he did, and he regained consciousness, that's when he thought, I was about to die. And I still hadn't found the truth. I still hadn't found liberation. Is this really the way? And that's when he started to doubt his practice. And it is said that around that time, he heard a bunch of musicians coming down, and the teacher was saying to the other students, when the harp string is too tight, when you play it, the string will break. When it's too loose and you play the string, no sound will come through. And the string has to be just right in order for the tune to be played beautifully. Now, isn't that a bit like life? And that's when Siddhartha started to reflect. His life in the palace was like a loose string. It was one extreme. But asceticism is also another extreme. That's when the string is too tight. So that's when he realized that he needs to find a balance between the two. And that's how the middle path, or the middle way doctrine, came about. The middle path doctrine is really important, because what it's about is the way we live our lives has to be in moderation, has to have a balance to it. we can't fall into either extreme. It is so important that it occurs in the first teaching, which we'll come to soon. But just remember that, the middle way, or known as the middle path. So after 6 years of asceticism, Siddhartha decided to abandon that practice and search for another way to find liberation. And the five ascetics who were practicing with him, they saw this, and they felt that Siddhartha was just weak and was going to give up the practice. And so they too abandoned him, thinking that he had fallen back. He was just too weak and he couldn't continue on. But remember the five ascetics, because they will come back soon. Now, do you remember the rose apple tree incident? Remember how I said we were going to come back to that? Well, after Siddhartha left the ascetic practice, that was the incident that he remembered. He remembered that state of natural contemplation and meditation, that natural calmness, and that ability to really penetrate and see the world. So he decided that that's what he was going to do. So he sat under a banyan tree, which is now called a Bodhi tree, but previously wasn't given that name. He sat under that tree, cross-legged, and he sat. And he meditated and contemplated. And it did feel like that experience of the rose apple tree. And he actually vowed that he will sit there and he will not stir, even, you know, if he is, and that's what they say in the scriptures, that the bones will disintegrate. He will sit there because that's his willpower, because he will find the truth. And so he did. And this is a picture of the night of his enlightenment. Here we have Mara's army. Now Mara, there's different interpretations of Mara. Some people say that that's an actual force, a force that is real. Sort of like the devil, I suppose, if we want to use the Christian paradigm. Something not so good. But really, Mara can be seen as a personification of the delusion, the defilements of our mind. And the defilements are greed, hatred, and delusion. So Mara is a personification of those evils and the way we attack our own bodies. And it is said that on that night of enlightenment, Siddhartha was able to subdue the armies of Mara, that is, his defilements, and that is how he reached enlightenment. And on that night of enlightenment, a few things occurred. There were three watches, and each watch lasts for about 4 hours. The first watch, he was able to see into his own past life. In the second watch, he was able to see into the rebirth process of all sentient beings, that everyone else goes through this rebirth. And the third watch is when he penetrated the truth of suffering and its release. And that is later known as the Four Noble Truths, which we'll come to. So that's his night of enlightenment. After Siddhartha was enlightened, he was called the Buddha. I can now refer to him as the Buddha. When the Buddha was enlightened, he didn't just get up and walk around. He actually sat and stayed in the same place for 7 days in contemplation. And one of the things he contemplated on was whatever he wanted to do with this knowledge that he now had. He had now understood a very, very deep truth. And he didn't know whether people would actually understand it. If he taught people, would people get it? Would people know? And at one point, he actually didn't even want to teach. He wanted to be like a silent Buddha. Okay, someone who understood the truth, but wasn't able to go and teach others. And it is said that a Brahmin king came and said to him, that pleaded to him to teach. And they used the analogy of the lotus. Some lotuses are stuck in the mud. They're in the pond. Can't really help them out. Then there are some which are surfacing, but still they're in a bud shape. And there are still some which is even further out, close to the sun, but they're also in a bud form. But all they really need is a bit of sunshine, a the Dharma, the truth, someone to guide them, and then it will blossom. So using the idea of the lotus, the Buddha was able to contemplate on that and thought, yes, for those who I can help, I will. And that's when he decided that he would teach. And so the lotus is a symbol in Buddhism that is very, very important because it shows not only purity, but also this particular instance as well. And the different stages in which people practice. Remember the five ascetics? Okay, they're going to come back soon. Now, the Buddha thought, okay, well, I've decided I'm going to teach. Who am I going to teach first? He thought in gratitude he was going to teach the two meditation masters, but they had already passed away. So he thought about the five disciples who practiced asceticism with him, and that's what he did. He found out that they were in Benares, in Deepa, Varanasi, in Deepa, and he decided to go there. And his walk there would have taken about a week. It took his time. And when he arrived, before he actually met the five ascetics, they saw him approaching, and they said to each other, "He's the one who abandoned the practice. We will not welcome him. We will not even speak to him." Okay, that was the pact. But as the Buddha drew closer, they couldn't help it. There was just something different about him. A sort of radiance, apparently. And they couldn't help it. So they welcomed him in, took his bowl, cleaned his feet. And that's when the Buddha gave the first sermon, the first teaching, which is the Dhammacakka Savatthana Sutra. Very briefly, this teaching begins with the middle path. And that's because he knows that these ascetics will understand. So first of all, he says, a way of luxury and looseness is not the way. Right? And of course, the ascetics will be agreeing, going, yep, we get that. But he says that even self-affliction, that is, asceticism, that is not the way too. That's another extreme that we should also avoid. And that's when the ascetics went, well, hang on, what do you mean? And that's when he said, we should walk the middle path, the middle way. And that's when the ascetics got interested. And from then, the Buddha was able to teach the Four Noble Truths. Very briefly, the first truth is the truth that suffering exists. The second truth is the reason for suffering, which is craving. The third truth is the truth that there is a freedom from suffering, and that is also summarized as nirvana. The fourth truth is the way out of suffering, and that is encapsulated in the Noble Eightfold Path. If you're interested, go to Unibuds Library and have a look. Okay. Now, for the next 45 years before the Buddha passed away, the Buddha taught. Now, these 45 years, as I mentioned, are so important because what we now know today is based on these 45 years. The Buddha passed away over 2,500 years ago, and yet we still talk about him and his teaching. That's pretty impressive. Ask any teacher, ask any lecturer, if their students can remember their teachings and pass it on for 2,500 years, that's pretty impressive. How did he do it in 45 years? Here are some of the stories to show not only that what type of person he was in terms of his compassion and his wisdom, but also what a great teacher he was as well. One of the first things he did was he taught the five disciples who he knew would understand it straight away because they had the condition to do so. Okay? When he gave the Dhammacakka Savatthana Sutra, that first teaching, only one of the monks actually attained enlightenment. Okay. After that, he taught the non-self or anatta sutra. Then the other four reached enlightenment. But what I'm getting at is all five reached enlightenment, and they then went and taught others. To the point that there were the first 60 arahants. So they sort of spread. And then the Buddha said to them, Let not the two of you take the same path to preach the Dharma for the welfare and happiness of all. 60 of them, he said to them, go your separate ways and spread the teaching. That was how he was able to do it. And a lot of times the Arahants weren't able to really preach to people, but at least they could give them what they know and then refer them back to the Buddha. King Bimbisara was, he never became a monk, but he certainly was a very important lay disciple of the Buddha, and one of the first lay disciples as well. King Bimbisara had a successful and thriving kingdom, and there was a reason why the Buddha decided to go and teach him, because he knew, first of all, that the king was a compassionate king, and secondly, that if he had the royal patronage, it was easier for him to successfully teach and spread the teaching. I highly recommend you going and finding out about King Bimbisara, because there's so many different stories associated with him. So how, for example, the king first approached the Buddha and was able to listen to what the Buddha was preaching about. You will hear about sacrifice and metta, loving kindness. That's the theme behind that. But also that King Bimbisara had said to Buddha, he was so impressed by his teachings, take my kingdom. Right? I will give you half of my kingdom if you will stay here. And the Buddha refused, because the Buddha was no longer interested in the worldly gain. I mean, half the kingdom, King Bimbisara had a pretty big kingdom, but the Buddha refused because his mission was to spread the Dharma, and that was so much more important to him. Okay. Now, it wasn't just monks who were part of the Sangha order. There were also nuns as well. And that was established through the request of Mahapajapati Gautami, who, and her story is quite interesting. Remember Queen Maya, who is the mother of the Buddha? After she gave birth to the Buddha, there were 7 days, I think it was, 7, 10, and then she passed away. Okay? After she passed away, her sister, who also was the king's wife as well, she then took on the role of being of caring for Siddhartha as if he was her own son. And her own son was given to the nurses to care for. That's how great her love was for this child as well as for her sister. So she was the first one who came and sought permission from the Buddha to be a nun. And it is said that she was able to make that request via Ananda, who is the cousin of the Buddha, but also the personal attendant. And he appears again and again in his stories as well. So 5 years after the Buddha's enlightenment, the order of nuns was established. And there's a lot of controversy over the establishment of the nuns and how that was happened. I'll leave those controversies aside. We won't talk about that today, but also something very interesting to talk about. But just remember that. Female equality in Buddhism. The fact that we have monks as well as nuns. To us, we may think like, oh yeah, you know, sure. But this is back in India, when there was the caste system. Okay, that is how rigid things were. And yet, the Buddha was able to say, yes, okay, let the women come into our order. That was actually a really big thing. As I said before, the Buddha didn't just leave his family. He actually went back and taught and took care of his family and brought them into his Sangha order as well. And he returned back to his family. I want to talk about three things in particular, three people whose Buddha touched when he returned back to his kingdom. The first is his father. When he entered into the kingdom, he saw his when he entered, through going through the villages, seeing the people, and the people came out and gave him an alms round. They gave him food. So essentially he was begging for food. The king was outraged, because the king felt That is my son, out there, begging for food in his own kingdom. His pride was obviously wounded. And he said, that's not on. So what did he do? He marched down there. And he said to the Buddha, how dare you? It is not our tradition to be begging for food. And then the Buddha replied, but it is my tradition. And the king said, what do you mean? But it is my tradition. I come from a line of Buddhas, and this is how we practice. So that's the first encounter with his father. So instead of reacting with anger, he reacted with kind compassion and that wisdom to allow his father to reflect on his own position there. A bit more talk, and his father allowed him to come back to the kingdom. The next person is the Buddha says is his own son. Yasodhara, his wife, says to Rahula, his son, go and ask his father for your inheritance. Right. Now, when you think about inheritance, what do you think about? Land, wealth, title. So, you know, Rahula's going up, you know, hoping that he's going to get, like, you know, a large sum of money or something. And then the Buddha thought, I know my son will think of wealth and possession as my inheritance to him, but there is something even greater that I can give him. And as you all know, the greatest gift is the Dharma. And so that's what he did. He taught the Dharma to his son and allowed him to be ordained under him and become part of his disciples. That's the second story. The last story is about Yasodhara herself. Now, I think Yasodhara's story is very touching. Yasodhara wanted to see the Buddha. So she went to her room and waited for him. And the Buddha, as he was walking towards her room with his two disciples, because obviously he can't be there alone, he passed by the king, and the king stopped him and said, your wife is a very loyal wife. When she had heard that you had abandoned shed your luxurious clothes and took on harsh robes, she too abandoned the royal robes and took on harsh cloth. When she heard that you were sleeping on the ground with no bed beneath your body, she too slept on the ground. When she heard that you only ate one meal a day, she too only ate one meal a day. That was how great her love was to support the Buddha. And she had done that and those different types of sacrifices throughout lifetime. You can read about that in the Jataka story. Anyway, so the Buddha then approached her room, and there she was there, and it was said that she fell to his feet because that was a sign of respect. And the Buddha actually praised her in front of the monks and said, if it wasn't because of you, I would never have reached enlightenment. If you hadn't supported me through lifetime. Now that's pretty humble for the Buddha to say, it wasn't just me who did this. You know, you had a part to play in the food. And of course, she was also ordained and made part of the her order, and later she would reach enlightenment herself. Whether you want to believe this or not, it's up to you, but it is said that the Buddha at one point flew up to the heavens where he preached the Abhidharma to his own mother in gratitude for her bringing him into this world. Okay? Now, why I mention this is because the Abhidharma is a central text to Mahayana Buddhist practice in particular. Okay? And so if you're interested in the Abhidharma, you may, when you read this, you will see that the context in which it was taught was actually in heaven, and this is why. Now, Devadatta, the cousin of the Buddha. Ever since the Buddha was very young, Devadatta was so jealous of him, incredibly jealous of him. There is one incident when the Buddha had, Devadatta was out hunting, and he shot down a bird, a white bird, and it fell and it was wounded. The Buddha quickly approached and healed the bird. And Devadatta went, "That's my bird, I shot the bird down." And the Buddha said, "Well, I healed the bird, so his life is mine." And then they had this debate. That conflict was then brought to the attention of the politicians, the Senate. So it came before them, and they ruled in the Buddha's favour. And they said, to save a life is to respect it, to appreciate it, and therefore you own it. So obviously the Buddha tended to the care of the bird, and the bird was given life. But Devadatta, he never forgot that incident. And throughout years and years and years, held an absolute hate and jealousy for the Buddha. And why he's such an important character is because sometimes we live our lives thinking we need to be perfect. We need to be liked by everyone. And if there is one person who hates us, we get really annoyed at that. We sort of think, like, why? Now, if you think about it, even the Buddha, so kind, so loving, even he had an enemy. So who are we to think that we need to have everyone to like us too? So that's the lesson to take from that. But Devadatta, through many, many attempts, had tried to hurt and harm the Buddha. And then eventually he became the disciple of the Buddha. And it got so bad that he even tried to create a schism in the Sangha order. He tried to create conflict so that everyone would disperse and hate the Buddha. He even tried to murder the Buddha a few times. And this is one of those incidents. He set a fierce elephant onto the Buddha. And you will see here a very nice depiction. The Buddha sort of stops him, you know, with a lot of his metta vibes, I suppose, with loving kindness. And then the elephant is subdued. And being subdued. The power of loving kindness. I remember when I first read this, I'm like, yeah, right. Is this like the walking seven steps thing? Is it symbolic? Until I actually felt the loving kindness of a great monk. And that's when I realized it's real. The radiance of metta is real. I can't put it higher than that. You need to experience it for yourself. Sina Manvitsa, she has a really cool story. There was some people who didn't quite like Buddha, as usual, right? These are non-Buddhists, and they weren't happy with the growing popularity of the Buddha. So they sent this beautiful woman to accuse the Buddha in front of all the public, and said the Buddha had got her pregnant. You see? Pregnant? Right? And you will see the Buddha sort of takes everything very calmly. I mean, if you think about it, if someone came and accused us of something like that in front of everyone, I mean, we won't be accepting it calmly. But you'll see in this picture, there's some mice. Can you see that? Just on the bottom? It says that the gods had transformed themselves into mice, came down, and they started to eat away at the string. And what that bowl really is, it's a basket cut up a string. So they nibbled at the string and the basket fell down. And that's when everyone went, "Oh, you're a fake," and started throwing stones at her and chased her out. That's the story. But here, I just want to say, sometimes we go through life and people defame us, people say lies, people say terrible things about us. How should we bear it? Look at the Buddha. Look how serene he is. Tissa. Tissa was a very old Sikh monk. And when the Buddha came to his hut, he realized that he had been abandoned by his fellow monks. They had just left him. They didn't care for him at all because they felt it wasn't their responsibility. So what the Buddha did was he cared for Tissa himself. He tended to the ugliness of the body with great compassion And he said to all of the monks, if you don't care for each other, who will care for you? And that's a very good way of putting it in terms of compassion, but also for the Sangha to have that harmony. We need to care for each other. Because when we are frail and old and sick, we would need their help eventually. Angulimala. This is one of my favourite stories. If I could take the time, it's about half an hour. This is Angulimala. That's his mum. That's the Buddha. Huh? Angulimala, when he was younger, I'll take you right to the beginning. When Angulimala was just born, his father was a wise, wise politician. Right? Who was assisting the king at that time. And luckily, that king was quite a reasonable type of king. Angulimala's father said to his said to the king that his son. He's predicted that his son will one day be someone who will harm a lot of people. That was his prediction, and he was very afraid. It is said that even his own father wanted to abandon him. It was because of the reasonableness and the kindness of the king who said, well, why don't we send him to a really good school? Maybe he'll be taught the right way. So he was given the name which meant the harmed one. Angulimala isn't his real name. But I'll just use that because people know that name. Anyway, so he went to this school, and things were going really good. In fact, he was surpassing all of the other students, and he was fantastic. And the teacher loved him. And of course, when people are good, there's always people who will be jealous. So, the other jealous students decided to plot against him. And so what they started to do was to nibble at the ear of the teacher and saying things like, Angulimala wants to harm you, he wants to hurt you, he wants to kill you. And the teacher initially didn't really believe it, but after a lot of people saying that, started to have doubts and started to go, yeah, maybe I need to protect myself, but I can't kill him myself. What can I do? And he decided that instead of making himself kill him, he will put Angulimala into a trap so that eventually he will be caught by the authorities. So he calls Angulimala over and says, we have a test. Every student has to pass this test. And your task is you have to collect 100 fingers. 100 fingers? Me. 100 human fingers. Mean I have to kill 100 people and get the fingers. Yep. 100 lives, 100 fingers. Come back to me after you've finished. And of course there's some debate like, I can't do that. Yes you can, you know, are you my student? You have to do it, blah blah. So eventually Angulimala was convinced and said, okay, I'll try. Now keeping in mind, Angulimala, he didn't start off this way, but he had these tendencies. Even when he was very young, he had this obsession with cruelty. And more importantly, he was actually very good at Warcraft. That was what he did. So he set out in his way, long story short, he killed. And he collected the fingers around his neck. They sewed them all together. And he became a monster. And when people saw him, they were frightened, obviously, with good reason. So they started to call him Angulimala. That was the name that was given to him. And what it means is the finger garland. Right? Because he would hang the fingers around his neck. Pretty good. Do you see? He collected 99. Some people say it's 999, so he wanted 1,000 fingers, but whatever. Okay, details. At the end of the day, 99 fingers. He was looking for the final one to complete his garland. And by then, he was pretty fed up and he was ready to, you know, finish this task and go back. Now, by that stage, the king had sent armies to come and try to kill Angulimala and stop him. But it didn't work. So the king found a few soldiers. And the king was mustering more and more troops to stop this murderer. this outrageous murder who killed absolute cold-blooded. The mother, his own mother, heard about this,
did she?
And she came running to stop him so that he won't fall into any more trouble with the king. You know, Angulamala, in his rage, he was ready to kill his own mother for that last finger. He was that deluded. And the Buddha knew about this, so the Buddha too came rushing over. And it is said that the Buddha found the mother, spoke to her as she went on her way, and instead he diverted the course of Angulamala's rampage towards his mother and diverted it so that he came running after this monk. Now it's said that the Buddha had supernatural powers which allowed him to walk at a very calm and steady pace. And Angulamala was running and running, running, running after him and just simply couldn't catch up to him. And then eventually Angulamala went, "Stop!" Yeah, huffing and puffing. And the Buddha turned around and said, "I have stopped." Angulamala said, "What do you mean you've stopped? I can't even catch up with you and I'm running constantly." And the Buddha said, "Angulamala, I have stopped. Why haven't you? I've stopped in doing evil deeds. Don't you believe in the law of karma?" And of course, back in those days, yes. And the Buddha said to him, I've put down my sword of hate and anger. How about you? When will you stop?" And usually the story sort of ends there and Angulamala is like, wow, this is fantastic. But if you hear the whole story, there's more to it. The Buddha actually stayed with him for a period of time. And through meditation and reflection constantly, Angulamala was able to see the wrong of his own way and was able to repent. So when it comes to Angulamala, the moral of his story is about forgiveness, it's about repentance. Even someone like him, a murderer, was able to change his ways and be accepted as a disciple of the Buddha. I'll continue with his story because there's actually more to it. Angulamala was allowed to follow the Buddha as a disciple, right? So he shaved his, you know, bushy beard and everything like that, wore the robe, didn't even look like Angulamala. And back then, when the disciples followed the Buddha, they had their heads down. And it is said that the king's army came looking for Angulamala. The king himself came to stop this. And they passed the Buddha, and they stopped. "Oh, Gautama." And they said to him, we've come to find the murderer, Angulamala. And the Buddha said, "If you find him, what will you do?" And the army said, "Well, if I find him, we will do horrible things to him, basically." And the Buddha said, "What if he has become a disciple of mine? What will you do?" And then they were shocked. "A disciple of yours? How is that possible?" And they go, ta-da, Angulamala. And they're completely stunned. But the king said, "If you leave the Sangha, you will immediately be arrested and executed." And with that, he left. That decision outraged a lot of people. So if you look at the Vinaya, the rule, there is actually one which says you can't simply just run from the law and become a disciple and think that's it. Okay, basically, that's what it says. But that's actually where it came from. Then there were the villagers. Obviously, the people who had been killed, their families were also very upset. And the Buddha basically said, this man had killed your family, but if you killed him, when does the blood stop? Now that law of karma. It is also said that Angulamala at some point wanted to kill himself too, because he just couldn't handle the guilt of what he had done, like finally realizing the impact of what he'd done. What the Buddha actually said to him was, "You've killed 99 people already, and now you want to kill yourself? How stupid. When are you going to stop?" That's also a very good lesson too. And then finally, the last part I want to talk about his story is, it's not like he became the disciple of the Buddha, he became enlightened, everything was fantastic. It didn't happen that way. For years, he had to bear the physical suffering as well as the emotional torment of the people who were upset at him. They would throw stones at him. They would bash him. Even in his robes, they wouldn't feed him. They wouldn't give him any food. They would yell abuse at him. You know, kids would throw stuff at him. And he would always come back to the monastery, you know, totally bruised. But that was his karma, and he wore it. And because the Buddha had said to him, this is what will come. Are you willing to accept that karma? And Angulimala had said yes. Then, there was one time when Angulimala was passing through a village and he heard the cries of a woman giving birth. And obviously there were complications in that pregnancy, and it was, and everyone was running around and they thought that the baby was going to die. He really wanted to help, but he didn't know how to. So he went to seek the guidance of the Buddha. The Buddha went to him and said, go back to that house, and what I want you to do is say, and with your sincerity, with the truth of the purity of all that I have done, with the good that I have done. With the life that I have led, with no, I can't remember the exact words, I'm sorry, but basically with no faults, right? With the good merits, this will be a successful delivery. Something like that. Incredible. And Angulimala said, well, I've killed 99 people. You know, how can I say a life without fault? And the Buddha basically said, well, since you've joined the Sangha order, since you've been here, you haven't done anything without fault. And Angulimala said, yes. So with the power of that truth, use it. And he did. So I went back, and that's what he said to them, and the villagers laughed at him and said, ah, you didn't do anything wrong. Are you kidding? So he came back and was like thinking, oh, I made a fool out of myself. Anyway, the villagers came knocking at the door late at night and said, Angulimala, you're our saviour. It actually worked. Okay. So then there became the Angulimala Sutra. You can actually look this up, which is often used for people who are delivering babies. And modern day Angulimala is now a Buddhist prison chaplaincy in the UK. So he has inspired even modern day prisoners to repent for the sins that they have done previously, to live, to turn a new life and live a new life. Yeah. You can search for that online if you want. So with the 15 minutes that I have left, I'd like to tell another story if that's okay. This is Gotami, okay? I love this story, can I just say, right? Gotami was a woman who grew up also in a very sheltered family. She's never experienced death, ever. And she had a baby. And at a very young age, the baby died. She had no constant understanding of what that meant at all. She had no idea what death meant. So, she went around knocking on all of the doors of physicians and doctors and said, help my baby, help my baby. And they all looked at her like she was mad, obviously, because the baby was already dead. Is it? Dead baby? Was. And they said, your baby's dead. But she didn't understand that. She's like, help my baby, save my baby. And then a kind gentleman said to her, look, I can't help you, but go and find the Buddha. So she did. She went and found the Buddha. And you know, the Buddha healed the baby. No, I'm just kidding. The Buddha said to her, and why this is such a good story is because it shows just how, what a great teacher he was. He knew that at that point, if he started to preach to her about impermanence and letting go, like, she won't get it. She's just too distraught. She doesn't get what death means. So what he said was, I want you to, I can save your baby if you can get something from me. just get some mustard seeds. Now, back then, mustard seeds were everywhere, right? Commonplace kind of stuff. So she's like, oh, how hard can that be? But he goes, oh, one condition. The mustard seeds must come from a household that's never been visited by death. Okay? Right. So, Gautami goes around the village, right? Door after door after door. Knocks on everyone. Can I borrow some mustard seeds? I need to save my baby. Yeah, sure. Oh, has death visited your house? Yes. 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 Every single house. And that's when she realized, in her own way, that impermanence visits everyone. Death visits everywhere. No one can hide from it. And so by that stage, when she came back to see the Buddha, she's already got that realization. So that's when the Buddha was able to really teach her about the truth of impermanence, about suffering and life. And with that incident, she was able to contemplate and eventually reach enlightenment as well. See, why I love that story is because, first of all, it shows, obviously, about impermanence, right? Really good story. But it also shows the type of teacher the Buddha was. Someone who was compassionate, never turned people away, but also someone who was very wise, who was able to use the best skills to teach their actual teaching. And with that, I'd like you to think about this. The Buddha's teaching, his story, every part of his life, there is a lesson to it. And you can't take it out of context. Right? You sort of hear about impermanence and I go, yeah, alright, impermanence. But how many of us really understand it? How many of us really understand the Four Noble Truths, what suffering is really like, unless we experience it? His teachings become valuable when we have something in our life that needs the solution to it. If we are faced with loss, that's when we really motivate ourselves to learn about impermanence. That's when we will sit there and understand it. And it's the same with suffering. Really, when life is going good, who wants to think about suffering? We want to think about happiness. It's when suffering happens that instead of running away, we sit and we really understand it, really investigate what is suffering and what's the way. So after 45 years of teaching, when the Buddha turned 80 years old, in his 80th year, he walked his final steps and he passed away. His passing away in Pali is called Maha, which is great, Maha Parinibbana. So it's not just Nibbana, but it is the final passing away. It is when someone who's enlightened also passes away. And it is his final rebirth. He will never be reborn again. He is out of the cycle of birth and death, which is samsara. And just for your information, he passed away in Kusinara, which is a pilgrimage place at the moment. When we did the Buddhist exhibition earlier this year, or when I was involved, I remember someone in the audience going and asking Ajahn Brahm about relics. Right? Relics are basically the remains of the Buddha, and after someone who's enlightened passes away, when they are cremated, instead of turning into just ashes and dust, they actually form these stones, right? And in a way, that's sort of like the final evidence of their attainment, okay? And it's something that is very well respected in Buddhism and Buddhist practitioners. It is something that inspires us. And the question that this young lady asked Ajahn Brahm is basically, what are Buddha relics? And Ajahn Brahm's answer is, never mind what Buddha relics are. It's about what are the relics of the Buddha. What has the Buddha left behind? And it's his teachings. Even 2,500 years after he's passed away, his teachings still ring true to us. That must mean something. The Buddha never said to us, listen to what I have to say. Believe what I have to say. He never said, this is some theory that's out there. He said to us, investigate, use what you can, And that's what I'll ask you today. Use what you can. If you took anything from this talk, if you take anything for the rest of the other Dharma talks that you hear, the teachings are there. What is useful is only useful when you put it into practice, when you apply it to your own life. There is no use sitting here and talking about Buddhism. How are you going to make it relevant? How are you going to make it real and bring it into your own life? The Noble Eightfold Path is really important because that, the Buddha says, is the fourth noble truth. It is the way out. It is what will guide you in your life to reach enlightenment. And you can take it superficially and it will help you, but each and every one has a deeper meaning, which I won't go into. But something for you to look into. These are the teachings of the Buddha. The story of the Buddha is endless. There are so many different sutras placed into a particular context. So Gautama is an example, Angulimala is an example. I encourage you all to go and read, learn more about it, and make the Buddha real for you. He was an amazing person. He wasn't just someone who you should bow down to because you need to, or simply because he is twice as new. That's much more. Any questions? Okay. Sure. It doesn't even have to relate to the Buddha story or even what I've talked about today. Yes? Sorry, we'll have to speak up. No, you're absolutely right. It's not. Right? The people who go and pray to the Buddha, or more like his statue, for things, they're not understanding the Buddha's teaching. Never has the Buddha actually said, pray to me and I give you this. And that's why this topic is so important. The Buddha isn't a god. The Buddha isn't there bestowing things on people. The Buddha isn't even there judging what you've done right to give you merit points, and what you've done wrong, and punishing you with karma. Right? Karma exists as it is. It's natural. No one can stop that. Even if the Buddha wants to enlighten people, he can't just sit there and go, bang, you're enlightened. He has to show them a way, and they must walk it. He says that all the time. He never once said to us, this is the central pleasure that you should go to. It will contradict his teachings completely. So I know that people do go to temples, just like when I was younger I did, and I would pray for good marks, for example. But now when I understand the Buddha's teachings, I realise it's not about that. And in fact, even if I can get it, that doesn't mean it's happiness. And I think that's the difference. I don't know much about Christianity, but if I could say a good word for it, I think that the real belief of Christianity is not about going to God and saying, take this pain away. I think it's more of an acceptance of what is happening, because I understand that it's about God's will. So that too shows that acceptance of it. But as I said, I can't speak on behalf of God. Christianity, but I think people are afraid of suffering, and they look to religion or to a higher being to take it away from them. It's almost like they're finding something else to do it, so they don't have to do it. And I don't think that that's what Buddhism is at all. The Buddha has always taught, this is the way, walk it. It's called the Noble Eightfold Path, not the Noble Eightfold Prayer, for example. We actually have to walk it ourselves. Okay? Does that answer your question? So the simple answer is yes, you're right. Anything else? Any other questions? Sure. Is it no questions, because what I've said is like, you know, right on, or are you guys like looking at the time and going, let's go? Yes. Yes. Oh, I think so. If you have right intention, that's good. That's good too, because there are different levels of intention. Sorry, I can't go back, but there's different levels of intention. A really nice analogy, for example, is when the Buddha talked about crossing the path of suffering, the river of suffering. When you cross the river of suffering, so on this journey of life, right, you need a raft. You need something to carry you through. And that is the good karma that we collect, for example. Right? It's the good deeds that we do. The good merits that we have. It is aspiring for good marks, for a good life, for happiness. The Buddha doesn't say, dwell in suffering so you can understand it. Okay? You don't even have to go and deliberately create suffering. It will happen. Okay? But the important thing is, when you get to a certain point, when you've crossed that river, you won't continue to carry that raft on your shoulders. At some point, you have to let it go. It's as to when, that's the question. Okay? There is nothing wrong with being successful at all, as long as you know how to deal with it. If success creates arrogance, pride, attachment, selfishness, fear, worry, then we should question whether success is really what we want. But it's also our way of dealing with success. Some people can be very wealthy, but very humble. Some people can be extremely intelligent, and yet very generous. Does that answer your question? Anyone else? All good? Okay. Right, well, thank you for your kind attention. I hope you enjoyed the talk. And there will be some announcements, I think.